Hello everyone, welcome to Stephen King Cast, one man's musings on the works of Stephen King. Each week I'll review one entry in the bibliography of Stephen King in the chronological order of publication, and this week I'm reviewing a little book from 2013 that doesn't get a lot of attention, that clocks in just under 300 pages, that is a deviation from his more famous horror and suspense genres that he is famous for, and instead he gives us just a little tale of becoming a man and growing up and finding oneself in a very, very brief coming of age story set against the backdrop of an amusement park of broken hearts and first loves and first heartbreak, all wrapped up in a little mystery thriller known as Joyland. Now, I am forevermore going to have very positive memories of Joyland. I distinctly remember picking it up and reading it in the spring of 2013. And I remember being out on the water in my kayak in June of 2013 in the morning of the day that I got married, and that's always going to be a part that when I think of that day, I'm always going to think of how I started that day, because I couldn't be in the house. I needed to get out of the house because I couldn't see my wife and she needed me out of the house, so I needed to stay busy. So I threw the kayak on the roof rack, drove to one of my spots, hung out on the water, just reflected on life, finished up this book. So it's always going to be there, and I just have nothing but good memories reading this book. It took me maybe three sessions of reading to really finish it. It goes by very, very quickly. And anyone that expects something horrific, you're not gonna get it. But anyone that enjoyed The Body or The Shawshank Redemption, I think that you're going to get something out of it. In my reviews of The Body and Stand By Me, and my reviews of Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption and The Shawshank Redemption, I discussed how if someone were to make Joyland into a movie and knocked it out of the ballpark, it would serve as sort of a thematic continuation of those novels and adaptations. But what I mean by that is Stand By Me is considered this surprise hit that, oh my god, it's a great movie, and Stephen King wrote it. And same thing with Shawshank Redemption. Oh my god, Shawshank Redemption, what an inspiring movie. I can't believe that Stephen King character wrote it. Same thing with Joyland. I think that if this was adapted into a really feel-good movie that captured the heart of this book, people would be surprised that it was a Stephen King story, because there's a lot of feels, if you want to use terminology of 2016. There's a lot of feels in this book. Like I said, it's nothing huge, it's nothing major, but it tells a very succinct story of a particular point in a young man's life, and it works. So I'm really looking forward to reviewing this along with all of you. And before I get to it, I just want to read a listener email. And for anyone that hasn't done so already, feel free to write in at StephenKingCast@yahoo.com. And if you haven't done so already, head on over to iTunes to leave a review and a subscription, because a review and a subscription, or even if you don't want to subscribe, if you don't have an iTunes account, if you want to just write a review, that would go a long way in helping me out. Okay, so listener email. Hello, sir. I'm a new listener, but a longtime Stephen King fan and reader. I love the show and have been going back and listening lots of the more current episodes as well as the older ones. My wife, a native Bostonian and the original King fan in our household, turned me on to your podcast. We live in Atlanta, #RIPStanUris, and we both really appreciate your heartfelt commentary on this great catalog of works. She hasn't taken the plunge into the crazy yellow brick road that is the Dark Tower series, but I have, to an obsessive degree, seriously. There's been a hole in my heart since I finished book 7, the same feeling you get after finishing anything that's left a significant impact on your life. It happened to me with It, The Stand, Salem's Lot, Insomnia. Stephen King, while not perfect, is the man. We're lucky to have him. Anyway, my question is, what do you think about King's repeated use of blue flame or blue fire throughout his works? I feel like it comes up a lot whenever there's a supernatural activity or some black magic going down. I don't know if it's specifically evil or not, but I know it appears when Randall Flagg does some of his crazy stuff, and I believe it shows up around Leland Gaunt at the end of Needful Things. I'm also pretty sure it's mentioned in Eyes of the Dragon. I know it pops up in The Dark Tower, as well as other books. Please help a brother out, and let me know what you think. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Is this detail something you've noticed at all reading King over the years? Am I crazy? It's gotten to the point that I now underline the words blue flame anytime they appear. I know good old Peter Straub has his blue rose, as opposed to King's red rose representation of the tower, but I'm super curious about King's blue flame. Ironically, there's a strip club in Atlanta called the Blue Flame. I've never been there, I'm a family man, but I just thought it was funny. So, yeah, that's it. Thanks for a great show. Your friend, J. Mike, from one reader to another. So, J. Mike, I don't know. I don't know if there's anything to it. The way that I see it is that it's just a... I don't know, just an image that I think that he likes to use. I don't know if there's a greater meaning to it. I've never personally thought that there's a greater meaning to it. But if anyone else out there thinks that there is, definitely feel free to write in. But that's a great observation. Thanks for finding it and sharing it. Okay, guys, so what I'm going to do now, I'm going to launch into the Wikipedia summary of Joyland. This novel is set in a North Carolina amusement park in 1973. And involves a carny who must confront the legacy of a vicious murder and the fate of a dying child. Devin Jones is a student at the University of New Hampshire who takes a summer job at Joyland in North Carolina. Devin is told during his interview by the resident fortune teller that he will meet two children that summer. One is a girl with a red hat, the other is a boy with a dog. One of them has the sight. After securing lodging for the summer at a rooming house and making friends with some of the other help, Jones finds that he has a talent for wearing the fur Joyland talked for portraying Howie the Happy Hound, Joyland's mascot. One day, he saves the aforementioned young girl in a red hat from choking on a park hot dog. The heroics earn him the trust and admiration of the park's owner. Devin and his friends, Tom and Aaron, learn that several years earlier, a girl had been murdered in the haunted house and her ghost still haunts the ride. Devin's friend, Tom, sees the ghost, but Devin does not and becomes interested in the murder. Aaron assists him later, showing him pictures and articles, proving that this was only the latest in a string of unsolved murders, which had never been connected by the police. At the end of the summer, Devin decides to take a year off from school and stay at the park while it's closed. He becomes close to a standoffish woman, Annie, and her sick son, Mike. Mike knows about the woman's ghost and has a dog, and Devin realizes he is the second child in the fortune teller's prediction. Devin is able to organize a private trip to Joyland for Mike. At the end of the trip, Mike's presence helps free the woman's ghost. That night, Devin loses his virginity to Annie with the understanding it was a one-time occurrence. Devin returns to his boarding house, which is preparing for an upcoming storm. He begins looking through the pictures again and suddenly realizes that the murderer is one of the park employees, Lane Hardy. Lane has guessed that Devin knows who he is, so threatens to kill Annie and Mike unless Devin meets him at Joyland. Lane traps the two of them on the Ferris wheel in the middle of the storm and is about to kill Devin when Annie shows up and fatally shoots Lane. Mike has been awakened by another ghost of a park employee Devin has previously saved, who warned him about Lane. Annie and Mike return to Chicago and Devin goes back to school. Mike dies later that spring. Analysis. So just let me read the opening here. I had a car, but on most days in the fall of 1973, I walked to Joyland from Mrs. Shoplaw's beachside accommodations in the town of Heavens Bay. It seemed like the right thing to do. The only thing, actually. By early September, Heaven Beach was almost completely deserted, which suited my mood. That fall was the most beautiful of my life. Even 40 years later, I can say that. And I was never so unhappy I can say that, too. People think first love is sweet, and never sweeter when that first bond snaps. You've heard a thousand pop and country songs that prove the point. Some fool got his heart broke. Yet that first broken heart is always the most painful, the slowest to mend, and leaves the most visible scar. What's so sweet about that? So right away, anyone expecting anything other than a coming-of-age story, any disappointment that you might feel is squarely on your shoulders. I mean, how much more explicit is he supposed to be? I guess if you pick up the book expecting terror or suspense, I can understand that. So I shouldn't be so harsh to judge. I mean, the tagline on the cover reads, "Who dares enter the funhouse of fear?" The back reads, almost comically, "All-time best-selling author Stephen King returns with a novel of carny life and death." But once you begin reading it, it's clear that this is going to be a character study of a formative time in a young man's life during an age that Stephen King does not often write of. I mean, he's explored childhood, he's explored teenage years, and that particular time period to perfection in It, in The Body, and then Christine. You know, he explored that in-between state where childhood and young adulthood meet. With Shining, with Pet Sematary, you know, he explores young parenthood. With Duma Key, it's an examination of your second and third acts of life. Here, Stephen King is going to speak about those first independent adult steps that one takes, where each step is both shaky and strong. I remember personally when I graduated from college, I was not equipped and I wasn't prepared for the life change that happens instantaneously. And I just felt that since the time I was in kindergarten, so from kindergarten until the time that you graduate college, you're told what to do and how to do it and when to do it. You know, whether it's an assignment or homework or just work or what classes you have to take, what you have to prepare for. It's all structured. And then they hand you a diploma and they say good luck and then they shut the door. And it's completely up to you. And you have to learn how to be an adult and how to function in this world. And it can be incredibly scary. And it was a post-college, the initial post-college part of my life, it was a pretty low point. And it was full of complete uncertainty and complete fear. And I just didn't know who I was. And I needed to really discover it and, you know, reinvent myself for who I needed to be in order to succeed in this world. And I don't know, maybe I'm just been, my eyes have been closed. I just really haven't seen that explored as often as I've seen, say, coming of age, right? This is a little bit different, and I'm glad that Stephen King is talking about it here in Joyland. But going back to expectation, if you begin reading and expect horror, I mean, shame on you. I mean, just look at the paragraph markers, for Christ's sake. They're hearts. I mean, this is a love story through and through. And there's a lightheartedness to this novel that makes it such a joy to read, but never not earnest. For instance, we get page 16. I'm not sure anybody gets completely over their first love, and that still rankles. Part of me still wants to know what was wrong with me, what I was lacking. I'm in my 60s now, my hair is gray, and I'm a prostate cancer survivor, but I still want to know why I wasn't good enough for Wendy Keegan. And though it will be a small-stakes novel, he still knows how to tease a mystery, for instance. When Dev Fertz gets the job, King states that he will both see and not see Howie, the Happy Hound mascot. I mean, this will be revealed that he is the mascot for that summer. So it's not as if it's a major mystery, but a mystery nevertheless. There's something about carny life that'll always be so mesmerizing, and it's one of this novel's successes. King uses Dev and his new-to-the-world eyes to immortalize a mythological carny world seen here in Joyland. And as first days go, Dev's first day is legendary. It's full of imagery so rich, it's our first day. And one by one, he gets to know his soon-to-be colleagues, which includes an ominous foretelling from the local psychic. But again, it's in a lighthearted, breezy manner, humorous, as she begins with a stage accent before losing it entirely. Now, this is going to be a difficult book to review, just so you know, because I have to stop. I would, you know, if I were to review it as thoroughly as I do other ones, I would have to stop at every page and share a Stephen King gem with everyone, some sort of life commentary that he's been able to distill in his writing. You know, so for instance, we have a segment on page 26. Maybe, I said, although I already knew what my future was going to be, writing novels and the kind of short stories they publish in The New Yorker. I had it all planned out. Of course, I also had marriage to Wendy Keegan all planned out, and how we'd wait until we were in our 30s to have a couple of kids. When you're 21, life is a roadmap. It's only when you get to be 25 or so that you begin to suspect that you've been looking at the map upside down, and not until you're 40 are you entirely sure. By the time you're 60, take it from me, you're fucking lost. So, this is a novel, guys. That should really just be experienced. But in terms of plot, before long, King gives us the skinny on the Joyland Ghost. King then backtracks to the days leading up to Dev's introduction to Joyland, detailing his love life, or lack of love life, with Wendy, before introducing us to Tom and Aaron, his Joyland co-workers and co-stars of this book. And on their first day, all employees are given a speech by the owner, Bradley Easterbrook, which serves as one of the underlining themes of the novel. And we get that on page 59. This is a badly broken world full of wars and cruelty and senseless tragedy. Every human being who inhabits it is served his or her portion of unhappiness and wakeful nights. Those of you who don't already know that will soon come to know it. Given such sad but undeniable facts of the human condition, you have been given a priceless gift this summer. You are here to sell fun. In exchange for the hard-earned dollars of your customers, you will parcel out happiness. Children will go home and dream of what they saw here and what they did here. I hope you'll remember that when the work is hard, as it sometimes will be, or when people are rude, as they often will be, or when you feel your best efforts have gone unappreciated. This is a different world. One that has its own customs and its own language, which we simply call the talk. You'll begin learning it today. As you learn to talk the talk, you'll learn to walk the walk. I'm not going to explain that because it can't be explained. It can only be learned. I hope you'll enjoy your work today, and when you don't, when, for instance, when it's your turn to wear the fur, try to remember how privileged you are. In a sad and dark world, we are a little island of happiness. Many of you already have plans for your lives, hope to become doctors, lawyers, I don't know, politicians. You'll have interesting, fruitful lives, my young friends. You'll do many good things and have many remarkable experiences. But I hope you'll always look back on your time in Joyland as something special. We don't sell furniture. We don't sell cars. We don't sell land or houses or retirement funds. We have no political agenda. We sell fun. Never forget that. Thank you for your attention. Now go forth. And King writes, he stepped away from the podium, gave another bow, and left the stage in that same painful high-stepping stride. He was gone almost before the applause began. It's one of the best speeches I ever heard because it was truth rather than horse shit. I mean, listen, how many rubes can put sold fun for 3 months in 1973 on their resumes? King then proceeds to detail Dev's first day in rich, clear detail. Eventually, it leads to the moment where Dev becomes Howie the mascot. It's written with love, like anything else in this novel, and with nostalgia. It's a well-composed segment full of fun, full of whimsy, and the laughter of children. He juxtaposes the joy and vitality of this scene, the essence of youth, with the unfortunate realities of life when he looks ahead to the future, where Aaron is twice married and Tom is dead by a brain tumor. Dev then gets confirmation that Wendy has dumped him for someone else, and it's brutal, meaning that we can see the truth even before Dev can. Dev mopes through the post-breakup blues, and the vision that Ron has given him is brought up again, of the woman and the boy with the dog. Dev has his hero moment when he stops a young girl from choking. Dev and Aaron and Tom then go into the haunted house ride in Joyland, wherein Tom is the only one to experience the ghost, King's way of teasing the mystery. And he humanizes this moment. It's not just a fun supernatural moment, but a moment that is going to affect this character for the rest of his life, especially when his end draws near. And we get that on page 120 to 121. Aaron tried to get more details while I drove us back to Heaven's Bay in my heap. Tom answered the first two or three of her questions, then said he didn't want to talk about it anymore in an abrupt tone I've never heard him use with Aaron before. I don't think she had either, because she was quiet as a mouse for the rest of the ride. Maybe they talked about it some more between themselves, but I can tell you that he never spoke of it again to me until about a month before he died, and then only briefly. It was near the end of a phone conversation that had been painful because of his halting nasal voice and the way that he sometimes got confused. "At least I know there's something," he said. "I saw for myself that summer in the Hasty Hut." But I didn't bother to correct him. I knew what he meant. "Do you remember?" "I remember," I said. "But I don't know the something, if it's good or bad." His dying voice filled with horror. "The way she... Dev, the way she held out her hands." "Yes, the way she held out her hands." Dev then makes the decision to extend his stay as a full-time employee after Labor Day, meaning that he wouldn't go to college in the fall. Summer ends, and Dev says goodbye to first Tom, then Aaron, in a moonlight walk along the beach, in which she kisses him and tells him that Dev would have been the one if Tom hadn't been there, which is nice, I guess, but what a tease that is. To me, like, yeah, it's very, very flattering, but something like that, I imagine, would do more harm than good. All the while, King keeps teasing the memorable fall that is soon to come. This begins when he begins to encounter Annie and her son Mike on his walks to and from work along the beach. And it's here where we can see where the novel is headed. This novel was published in the Hard Case Crime, and what's a crime story without its femme fatale? Annie is standoffish at first, but will soon do for Dev what Aaron couldn't, and make him forget all about Wendy. Dev begins to obsess over the ghost of Linda Gray, which makes sense, as he's been mopey and half-assed suicidal thoughts from the first heartbreak. He's partially in love with death, symbolized here by the ghost itself. And now that the summer of fun is over, King can begin to zero in on the mystery. Who killed Linda Gray? Our first suspect is Eddie, whose mean temper and predilection for glove-wearing makes Dev suspicious of him. Naturally, this means that we should automatically rule him out, because it's too obvious. King then gives us the first real meeting between Annie and Mike and Dev, where Dev helps the son fly a kite. It's a nice moment that allows the mother to begin to thaw, just slightly, towards Dev. This continues with their breakfast smoothies, where we get a conversation between Mike and Dev, specifically the heartbreaking truth of Mike's short lifespan. He really ups the heartbreak here as Dev gets to know them. As Dev gets to know them better, leading to a moment in the hospital where Mike demands to be taken to Joyland before he dies. And we get that on page 183. "She stopped struggling. Warily, I let go of her. The novel she'd been reading had fallen to the pavement in the struggle. I bent down, picked it up, and put it into the pocket on the back of the wheelchair." "Mom," Mike took her hand. "It doesn't have to be the last good time." Then I understood. Even before her shoulders slumped and the sobs started, I understood. It wasn't the fear that I'd stick him on some crazy fast ride and the burst of adrenaline would kill him. It wasn't the fear that a stranger would steal the damaged heart that she loved so well. It's kind of atavistic belief, a mother's belief. And if they never started doing certain last things, life would go on as it had. Morning smoothies at the end of the boardwalk, evenings with the kite at the end of the boardwalk. All of it in a kind of endless summer. Only it was October now, and the beach was deserted. The happy screams of teenagers on the Thunderball and the little kids shooting down the splash and crash water slide had ceased. There was a nip in the air as the days drew down. No summer is endless. The two plot points start to converge as Mike, blessed with the gift of sight, which others might call the shining, says that one of the reasons he has to go to Joyland is to help her, meaning the ghost of Linda Gray. Meanwhile, Aaron and Tom return to visit Dev, and Aaron comes with research revealing that Linda Gray looks to simply be one of many girls killed all in similar fashion. A new wrinkle that Evan, Aaron, and Dev discover is that the tattoo on the killer's hand is a fake, most likely placed there to attract attention to it, a washable red herring. We switch gears to Mike's magic day at Joyland, with Fred Dean stepping into the role of a Willy Wonka-type character. It's a wonderful sequence, the heart of the story, really. And King anchors it to something that we can all relate to. We get that on page 220. I remember Mike's day at the park, Annie's day too, as if it happened last week. It would take a correspondent much more talented than I am to tell you how it felt, or to explain how it could have ended the last hold of Wendy Keegan still held over my heart and my emotions. All I can say is what you already know. Some days are treasure. Not many, but I think in almost every life there are a few. That was one of mine. And when I'm blue, when life comes down on me and everything looks tawdry and cheap, the way that Joyland Avenue did on a rainy day, I go back to it, only to remind myself that life isn't always a butcher's game. Sometimes the prizes are real, and sometimes they're precious. Not only does Mike have the best day of his life, but King allows Joyland to function for Dev what amusement parks have been to so many others throughout history. A place to fall in love. To have those magic moments. So when he kisses her, we're all rooting for him. We're all in the moment with him. This kissing, of course, leads to another magical moment, followed by two more magical moments when they get back to her place. And later that night, Dev discovers that he knows the identity of the killer, who calls him in the middle of the night, showing that he knows that Dev knows. This heads towards the final confrontation in Joyland, deserted, with a hurricane beginning to whip around them. There's a fake-out, as King teases us, that Fred Dean is the killer because he had mentioned the flowers that he'd given to Annie before revealing that it had been Lane Hardy all along. Lane takes Dev up on the Ferris wheel and just as he's about to kill Dev. It's phenomenon all over again, guys. Just as he's about to kill Dev, really don't know what happened there, Annie, who had been urged to save Dev by Mike, who had been visited by the ghost of Eddie Parks, uses her rifle skills, which had been teased throughout the novel, to shoot him in the face. And then from there, the last thing to wrap up is the story of Mike. He passes away off the page, and King closes his book with Dev and Annie and Milo on the beach, with Dev running the kite into the sky with the cremated remains spilling into the wind. So, Easter eggs. We have Revival. Charlie Jacobs from Revival will refer to Joyland in the pages of that book. And two, we have Inside View, the tabloid magazine that it's mentioned here in this story. And we have seen it in numerous Stephen King entries, with the writer Richard Dees playing roles in both The Dead Zone and Nightmares and Dreamscapes story Night Flyer. So, I know this was a short review, guys. I mean, it's just about 30 minutes. And you know what? I'm a little ashamed of myself because I don't think that I spent the time that I could have with Joyland. I guess all that I can say is that it really is a well-done story. It is plotted very, very well. It's never about the plot. It's always about the characters. Like, you really feel for Dev. Like, you get it. You kind of laugh at Dev. You your heart gets broken for Dev. You sympathize with Dev. You want to give him a kick in the butt to get him moving. It's a good story. And the entire time I read it, I was thinking a lot of the movie Adventureland that came out a couple years ago with Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart and Ryan Reynolds. To me, it has a very, very similar tone. And I would be interested in revisiting Adventureland just to watch it again, because it's really, again, all about, you know, a little bit of heartbreak, pining for someone, working at, you know, an amusement park during a very formative period in your life. So it hits the same beats as this particular novel does. But with that said, I'd still like to see Joyland be made into a top-notch movie. Because I've said in other reviews that I think that if it was made into a movie, it would still have that respected feel-good place in cinema that The Body has and The Shawshank Redemption has. So I think that there's a great potential in turning this into a movie, and if it was, I think that it would surprise people the way that, for whatever reason, I don't know why people are surprised when they find out that something good is a Stephen King story. But those people are still being fooled, as seen as most recently in The Bazaar of Bad Dreams, where at one point King references a situation where he was in a supermarket and a woman says, "You're Stephen King. I don't read your things. I like feel-good movies like The Shawshank Redemption." You know, and I love that interaction. It just really cracks me up. But yeah, some people don't believe that Stephen King does quote-unquote good things. And Joyland is a perfect example of Stephen King doing a good thing. So that's really all I have for this particular story. It's worth reading. It's not going to take you very long. I reread it in a day and a half for my reread. And like I said, I read it the first time in just a handful of reading sessions. It goes by like that. The characters, you get into them right away. King does such a phenomenal job at speaking to life events and just musings on life. Though he's writing it in his 60s, he's able to capture the early 20s perfectly, much in the same way that when he was in his 30s, he spoke of childhood and being 11 and 12 perfectly. I felt that he was 11 or 12 when he wrote those pages in It. And he very easily could be 20, 21 when he was writing this. I mean, that's the strength of King there, guys. That's definitely the strength of King. All right, so let's look ahead. Next episode, I will be reviewing the much-anticipated sequel to one of Stephen King's most famous stories, both on page and on screen, the genre-changing one of the most influential pieces of pop culture, The Shining, the sequel to The Shining, 2013's Dr. Sleep. So I'm very excited to talk about this one. And make sure that you stick around for that one, because it's going to be a good one. So in the meantime, may you have long days and pleasant nights, and I will see you here next episode, where M-O-O-N spells Stephen King, guys.